Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Paul Bunyan of the Education Reform Community, Andy Smerick.
Hello, Mike. How are you? I hope you don't mind I left my ox outside.
Yes. Now, listeners, because this is an audio podcast, you don't know what I'm talking about, but Andy is sporting a very nice beard, quite a full beard, and it's got a bit of a reddish tint. Maybe we can have somebody... use their cell phone and take a picture. We'll get that up on the web. It's a good-looking beard.
Well, I appreciate it. It was organic in nature. I just didn't shave for a while and went on vacation. Next thing you know, I look like Paul Bunyan, I suppose.
Slacking off and then just not deciding to shave, and this is what we got.
That's
look,
right.
Not every guy can pull this off. Speaking for myself, I cannot pull this off. And you would think so because I am a hairy Italian guy.
Wow.
And yet...
Wow.
Well, this is not a well-kept secret. I mean, I like to sometimes, unbutton my top button and people see I got some chest here I'm sporting. So, but I can't get it on my face very well.
Well,
I've always been upset about this. I mean, my friends used to tease me in middle school about stuff like that. Anyways.
I guess I should add this to my resume. Ability to grow a beard.
Yes, I think
I should be proud.
Especially, I don't know. I think it makes you look a little bit lefty, though.
I've actually heard that from a couple places. When I first left the administration, I didn't shave for a while, and people said, oh, you're going to go into the lefty think tank world and wear tweed jackets and grow a beard.
Yeah. No. See, I think your true feelings are coming out.
Well, if it's up to my wife, it will be gone soon, so we'll see how much longer it lasts.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, Andy, we got a lot to cover.
Yep.
This is the big back-to-school period, and lots
right.
happening. So we're going to dive right in. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly with intern Janie is going to be asking us the questions. And then Amber's going to give us some research minute. And finally, Stafford will rate that reform. And I got to tell everybody, Mickey has stepped in for Laura this week to do the producing on the show. And, Mickey has played almost every role in the show now. I mean, he's asked questions. He's done rate that reform. He's now producing. He just needs to do research minute and host the show, and he's going to have it all.
Very versatile. If you're a baseball player, you get a big contract, you're able to play all these different positions.
I think versatility is a 21st century skill.
Indeed it is.
Indeed, Mickey, one of our millennials, has definitely got it.
You're a renaissance man when it comes to the podcast.
That's right. Okay, let's get started. Janie, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. This weekend, the New York Times featured a piece on teachers who let their students pick their own books instead of teaching the classics like To Kill a Mockingbird and Moby Dick. Is turning the study of literature into a class on reading skills a good idea?
So, I'm of two minds of this. So the
it's
first
a terrible idea.
No,
how can you be of two minds on this one?
So
straightforward.
So I think it's a good idea, anything we do to get kids to read more. And the fact that kids
like
don't...
Like destroy their English lit class? How is that going to get kids to learn? Okay, sorry.
So read more is the general rule. I mean, the fact that so many... I mean, I can't overemphasize how many students go to college now and they think that text writing is the way that you write, or this sort of like tweet writing where just grammar goes away and punctuation goes away. So anytime you read more, I think it's a good thing. But I am old school conservative in the sense that I think that there is a canon of great literature. And although it is too biased currently and has been for a while in what old white dead men, there is a difference between good literature and bad literature. And so if we could somehow get kids to read more, and if that means whetting their appetite with stuff about vampires, so be it, but then get them into the better stuff.
Look, first of all, I don't know that it's fair to say anymore that the old white dead men are the canon. I mean, I think if you went into a lot of schools today, you would see a very diverse set of offerings. But look, Diane Ravitch said it best in this New York Times article. She said, look, people are supposed to, if you want to get people to read what they're interested in, some of these novels or trashy novels or adventure novels, that's fine. They do it on their own mm-hmm. time. Okay. We've had a long tradition. We've expected young people to read at night on their own. But English literature class isn't just about teaching reading skills. It's also about teaching literature and teaching, as you say, this canon, and having some group discussions about some of the big issues that people face in life, about issues we face in our society. You got to have something common that kids are reading in order to have those discussions about some of those common values. And look, I'm fine with, if you want to have a very more flexible canon, certainly we should be adding titles to that canon. But the idea that we're not going to have group discussions about particular books, I think we're really being losing something in this country.
I completely agree. There's a great book that I recommend to a lot of people. I don't know if he's still there, but his name's Harold Bloom. He had been a professor at Yale, and he wrote this fantastic book called How to Read and Why, and it makes the case for the differences between good literature, bad literature over years and years and years, and it's actually made me more conservative on this, just in the sense that we should be discriminating about what we get kids to read. But I still want kids to read.
You know, Howard Bloom, I think he had a beard. So, I mean, this doesn't, you know, and he's considered a conservative on some of these things. So, I don't know, maybe you can keep the beard after all. Okay,
maybe.
Janie, question number two.
Boston school officials have announced the creation of a parent university, which will offer seminars to parents on everything from dealing with their child's homework questions to improving their resumes and applying for jobs. Should the school system really be the entity heading this initiative?
Sure, I don't have a problem with that. I'm not super optimistic that this is necessarily going to work. I think there's been lots of these kinds of efforts over the years to try to teach parents to be more involved and help them know how to, you know, check their kids' homework and be of help. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And of course, we know that it's incredibly important for parents to get involved in their kids' activities. There's some specific things parents can do that seem to really matter. But again, I don't have a lot of optimism that it's necessarily going to work. I don't think that parents are not doing these things because they are ignorant of what they're supposed to be doing. I think that there's cultural issues. People, you know, poor parents are working two or three jobs. They're stressed out. They got, you know, so I'm just not sure you're going to overcome that by adding this kind of information. It's kind of the same view that when it comes to professional development and teachers. It assumes that, for example, teachers would be teaching better if they just knew how. That might be true to a point, but there's also all kinds of other reasons that they might not be teaching ways that makes sense.
So in general, I get nervous when people spend a lot of time and money on parental engagement. And every principal or teacher that I've ever talked to who was part of a good school wants their parents to be more engaged. However, for years and years and years, we've allowed the lack of parental engagement to be an excuse for schools not working. So if a school is failing, a lot of the teachers or principals can say, oh, well, the parents aren't engaged, there's nothing we can do. So anytime we obsess about parental engagement, my alarm goes off and I start to worry, oh, is this just a way that we can create, you know, another reason why our schools aren't doing well? So if you look at these great schools, like that David Whitman in the book published by Fordham made this argument that a lot of these high-performing, high-poverty schools, they try to get the parents engaged, but if it doesn't work, well, they push on anyway, and they just get it done. Yeah. So, fine, go ahead, do this, get parents engaged, but by no means allow that, the lack of parental engagement, to be an excuse for the schools not working.
Yeah, I wonder if they're in some ways is inspired by the Harlem Children's Zone model, where they do have baby college as part of their model, where they teach parents how to be better parents and how to do all this stuff. But again, that's part of a larger, more intensive wraparound program. I'm not sure as a standalone thing it'll make much sense, but hey, why am I, no harm in trying.
If anyone knows of a good body of research that shows that state or city-wide parental engagement programs succeed, I'd love to see it. But I know too many, even in my home state of Maryland, where they try to spend a lot of money and, eesh, not many results.
Okay, Janie, topic number three.
All right. In Los Angeles, top-ranking school officials will now be subject to a merit pay system. These high-level administrators, including the superintendent, Ramon Cortines, can gain or lose up to 10% of their salaries based on a set of performance criteria, including student test scores. Should more districts follow suit?
Not only should more districts follow suit, I have a proposal. Everybody listen up. Here's how it goes. Arne Duncan's salary should be tied to the next NAEP scores.
Oh.
Okay? If we see NAEP scores going up, I think Arne deserves a raise. But if we see some flat scores or declines, dock them.
Is that all you have to say about this?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Well, I think the obvious reason that I would be opposed to that is the same reason why I'm kind of opposed to this, which is how much effect really can Arne Duncan have, even in the short term, even in the long term, on NAEP scores. So in general, I've been reading more and more about some of this merit pay stuff because it's such a big part of the race to the top. And I worry that people might be confusing or looking at merit pay the wrong way. In my opinion, we shouldn't expect that merit pay, performance pay in administrators or teachers is going to change the effects on student learning now or even anytime soon. I think what it can do is change the pull factors into education. It will get a whole brand new type of person, maybe more entrepreneurial, maybe a little bit more ambitious, to come into the profession, and that will have effects down the road. I just don't want anyone to think, especially with the race to the top, you institute a merit pay program, next year student test scores are going to go up. That's not how it's going to work.
That's right. And the other concern is to make it too formulaic. I mean, what it sounds like from the article, at least, is that you're talking about, okay, test scores go up by X percent, then the salary goes up by Y percent.
Yeah.
I think that's very dangerous for at the teacher level, the principal, any level. I mean, in the professional world, people certainly have performance metrics that they're tracked on and that they're expected to meet. But I think my sense is, in most workplaces, that information goes to a supervisor who then takes all the information plus other information, subjective
yes.
information, and makes a decision about how much of a bonus or how much of a salary increase that person should get.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be some guidelines based on what those metrics look like, but it's not automatic, it's not formulaic, and that's the way it should be. And we know these tests are far from perfect, they mm-hmm. weren't designed for all this. So it's important information. Of course, superintendents should not be getting big raises if student achievement is not increasing over time. I think that's fair to say, but the information should be seen in context, and the boss of the superintendent, the school board, should look at that information and other information when making this kind of decision.
Yeah, just in Baltimore, there was an article that the CEO there, Dr. Alonzo, got something like a $19,000 performance bonus this year, not just based on test scores, but his willingness to implement some new innovative programs that down the road have some potential to do it. So I think your fundamental point is right one, which is let's not be too formulaic about this. Let's realize that all these different folks in different positions, their end goals are actually going to be different. And like Rick Hess has pointed out, it's not just all about test scores. You can judge education yeah. success in many other ways.
You know who's not formulaic?
Who's that?
Amber Winkler and her Research Minute.
Segue.
Now, see, what our listeners don't know is that Amber's annual bonus is in part depending on how many times throughout the year she can keep it to 60 seconds
oh,
or shorter.
Oh, no, I've lost so much money.
I know. Cha-ching, cha-ching. Just kidding. See, that would be a stupid use of a formula.
That's exactly right.
But still, Amber, keep it a 60 seconds.
I'm going to try.
Take your time,
Please
Amber.
Don't let him be rude and cut me off, Andy. Will you?
I'll
help
kick
me
him.
Out here. All right,
Amber, what are we talking about today?
This week, we have a new public opinion study out of Education Next called The Persuadable Public by William Howe and colleagues. It's a nationally representative sample of U.S. adults that gauges their opinion on merit pay, charter schools, and school vouchers, among other topics. The survey also examined variations in responses based on how a particular question was posed. Specifically, some respondents were just provided the survey question without context, others were told how President Obama felt about the issue, and others were told what research said about the issue. In short, those informed of Obama's support for merit pay and charter schools favored those things more than those not informed of his opinion. In fact, 11 to 13 percentage points more. Likewise, the number of respondents favoring charter schools dropped by 11 percentage points when informed of the president's opposition to them. When told about research findings pertaining to these topics, support or opposition rose or fell according to the positive or negative nature of the findings, similar to the impact that the president's opinion had. Typically, collective public opinion on many education issues is pretty stable, but, the authors conclude, it can be swayed by the stance of a popular president or well-publicized research.
Whew. Well done.
Very well done.
Well done. You did get a little bit over,
little
but you
long,
know what?
Well, not too
I'm not
bad.
Gonna, I think it was worth it.
It was well worth it.
You got to pack it in, you know?
The Obama effect. So,
the Obama effect.
I should admit, you know, I'm on the editing team of Education Next, which is where the study came out, and I think it's a really cool study. I'm always excited with these polls where they do the experiments. You know, mm-hmm. it's one thing to ask the poll questions, but to experiment and see, well, if you ask it this way or that way. Or it's important to point out, though, this poll was taken, do you remember when the poll was taken?
March. Yes, March.
How many more people in America had favorable views of President Obama in March than they do
right,
today?
Well, actually, I don't think that this is as hinged as much to presidential popularity as it is hinged to presidents. So, mm-hmm. Keep in mind that when President Bush was pushing the No Child Left Behind Act, he wasn't at 90% approval rating. He was probably in the, say, high 50s at that point. It was still early in his administration. And the Republicans in Congress, Republicans everywhere, for years had been very opposed to the idea of the federal government getting intrusive, meddling in education. And yet when a president, who was moderately popular at the time, pushed an education issue, his party fell in behind him, and the public did. I think this just speaks to the fact that most people don't know that much about the gory details of education. education policy, mm-hmm. and they're looking for some guidance. And when the head of state, the head of government comes out and says, let's do something, I think a lot of times people just give him or her the benefit of the doubt and we'll go that way. So I wouldn't have titled this the Obama effect. I think it's more interesting to think of it as the presidential effect.
But I think it certainly depends on what your view of that president is. I mean, right. I think if Richard Nixon at the height of Watergate had come out in favor
true.
Of yeah. vouchers. Wait, he did come out in favor of vouchers. I don't think that, you know.
How did that work out?
Exactly. That didn't tip the public.
But this fell along lines, too. You know, I mean, the Democrats, when they disaggregated it,
they went up higher.
They went up, and the Democrats, I mean, the Republicans, not so much, so.
Right, right.
But even Jimmy Carter, who wasn't all that popular, was able to push through the creation of the U.S. Department of Education, because he said this was very important, and there were a lot of people, including Republicans, opposed to it. So I would just like to see data going back, or even looking forward, about how much just the president saying, hey, let's do this on education matters more than on other issues.
I think, look, it's clear there are, the idea of there being opinion leaders, I think, is for real. Mm-hmm. That people don't have time to follow every issue and all its complexities, and so they look to people that they trust. The president could be a columnist that they really respect, you know, a newscaster, and they look for signals from those people.
Researchers.
Yeah.
Well, having come from the charter school world, I became very familiar with how we could do all this research we wanted. But once Oprah Winfrey focused on three charter schools on her show and Bill Gates started talking about charter schools, that made a whole lot more difference than when I was talking about charter schools.
Yeah. Well, Andy, I don't want to break it to you, but you're
I'm not
great
Oprah.
At what you do.
I'm no Oprah.
You're no Oprah. No, I'm just teasing. You might be Oprah someday.
Dare to dream.
The Andy Smarek Show. I like it. All right, Amber, thank you. What's the song
you
that goes along
welcome.
With these findings?
Well,
today?
It's pretty easy this week. We have the Obama girl singing I've Got a Crush on Obama.
I got a crush on Obama. Can't wait till 2008. Barack Obama. Baby, you're the best candidate. I like it when you get hot on Hillary.
Mike, I had forgotten about this song. And I'm happy I had forgotten about this song.
Look, I think you got to talk to Amber about selecting.
Hey, did you pick this, Amber?
Mickey helped me this week now. All fault and goes to him. But actually, I kind of liked it. I picked another Obama song, but it wasn't as quite catchy as this one. So.
You know, it reminds me of a couple years ago when we did our spoof in the April Fool's Day gadfly, and we had a little section on the NCLB girl, which was Margaret Spellings, much of our staff finds offensive.
Hey, before we jump into this next section, I just want to say that I think Janie did a nice job. She's new to the team.
Absolutely.
And her first time here, she did get nervous or anything, and I think she's no Christina yet with that NPR voice. Yeah. But she still did herself proud.
She brought it. And you know who else is bringing it?
Who's that?
Stafford and Rate That Reform.
Hey, Stafford. Again, Mike with his dancing.
I think that's the best part. In fact, when I chose this intro song, I chose it for its danceability.
Yes, you did. You chose well, Stafford. You chose well. So finally, the school year has started again. We don't have
know.
To scrape the bottom of the barrel.
Very
Maybe.
Exciting.
We'll
what
see.
What you got for us?
I have swine flu. Not literally, although I am a little congested. So the school's back in session. So many things for an administrator to take care of. Enrollment info, medical forms, class schedules, and H1N1, the dreaded piggy flu. Most schools are just putting hand sanitizer in classrooms and preparing to send home students who display any symptoms. But one district in Long Island has gone further, channeling the germ-phobic helicopter parent to a T, the no-touching ban. What does this mean? No hugging, no high-fiving, no fist-bumping, no chest-bumping, no handshakes, no back-patting, no cheek-pinching, and certainly no kissing. Because, you know, viruses can't be airborne or left on off-to-touch surfaces, obviously. I get the point here, but banning kids from touching each other is like banning an alcoholic from drinking. Well-intentioned, but hardly enforceable. So I gave this one a B-.
A B minus?
A B minus, because it was well intentioned.
Okay, I have two words for you. Gym class. What do you do about gym class?
This is very true. What do you do about sports practice?
Thank you. Football.
What do
soccer,
you do about
any contact sport?
Lab.
Wrestling?
Science lab.
There's not. I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to play ping pong in gym class? Is that it?
No sweating at all.
So I have two nephews who had swine flu over the summer. Like, it turned out, like, they had a cold. I mean, maybe I've just too skeptical about this, but swine flu really isn't all that bad, is it? I mean,
it depends how badly you get it, but
I was worried when I heard they had swine flu.
I have some
flu.
Friends who've gotten it too, and it was just like they had a cold.
All right.
Stafford, explain to me, a B minus. I mean, that's really
I mean, it's
generous.
Because, okay, I gave it a B minus because...
The soft bigotry of low expectations.
I know, I mean, you're coming off the summer.
All right, fine, we'll give it an F. It's a stupid
it's
idea.
Grade. I'm just saying.
It's a stupid idea, yes, but unlike some of these other... reforms that I've talked about in the past, which have addressed the wrong problem. Like, I think this is at least trying to address, like, a respectable problem in a respectable way, not being completely ridiculous.
See, I think the unintended consequences here are vast. I mean, for example, what is going to happen to the self-esteem movement? I remember learning in middle school that it was very important to get several hugs a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's... There's research backing this. I mean, all these kids are walking around not getting hugged. Some psychopath is going to come out of that school, and I don't know, we're going to look back on this and say a B minus was not the right grade. All right.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Stafford.
Get tougher.
That is all the time we have for this week.
It was fun.
It you know, Andy, it was fun. Ooh. And I want to see if Paul Bunyan's going to be back in the studio next week, too. Until then.
I'm Paul Bunyan.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
Do we hug each other now?
We hug each other.